hope you're ready.
The Committee on Health and Human Service Policy is called to order. We do not have a quorum, so I see our first testifier is all set and ready to go. All right, so we have House File 922, Representative Lisgard.
Lisgard, yeah.
Lisgard. So the chair cannot move your bill right now. So why don't you just open up by telling us a little bit about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a highly technical bill, and it's regarding well and boring. And I'd be lying if I said my eyes didn't gloss over as I read what I have to tell you. So please bear with me. House File 922, the well and boring industries are comprehensively regulated by the Minnesota Department of Health in state statute and rule, and industry has thorough best practices in place. All parties have good working relationships with the agency. The provisions included in House File 922 passed the legislature in 2018. All of the provisions included in this bill were non-controversial. It was part of the omnibus bill voted by then-Governor Dayton. All parties are supportive of the bill, MDH engineers, Water Well Association, and industry. The bill modifies provisions governing wells and boring, including definitions, notice, fee, reporting, and sealing requirements. Specifically, the bill clarifies the boring definition by adding temporary boring in Section 1, clarifies an environmental well is not an exploratory boring in Section 2, better defines temporary boring in Section 3, adds temporary boring to the license requirement to the construct, repair, or seal a temporary boring, and clarifies when a license is not required in Section 5. Moving on. Changes a reporting requirement from 30 to 60 days after completion of work in Section 6, specifies that temporary boring and an exploratory boring less than 25 feet in depth are exempt from fees and notification requirements, Section 4, 7, 8, and 10. Adds a section for the sealing of temporary borings in Section 9. And clarifies that the $275 fee is set for each exploratory plan as opposed to each hole in Section 11. These provisions provide certainty and clarity for all parties. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope that was understandable. Okay. I have a lot. The agency here and other individuals that can answer any technical questions, but what I read is about as far as I go.
All right, but thank you so much for your testimony and your bill. Before we get started, members, we do have a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March the 26th?
I'd like to move the approval of the minutes, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Fisher moves the approval of the minutes for Tuesday, February the 26th. March the 26th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for Tuesday, March the 26th are approved. All right, so why don't we move into our testifier? Would you? I'm going to move the bill really quickly. The chair moves that House File 922 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Yeah.
We have heard of the bill.
Yeah, and there is a DE amendment.
Do you have a DE2-1 amendment? With the chair would entertain a motion to move the DE12 amendment. Anyone? Okay. Representative Pinto moves the DE2-1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay. To the testifier, Gerard Miller.
No, Madam Chair, I'm Chris Albin with the Health Department. I'm just here to answer any questions.
Any questions, okay. So do we have anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 922? Members, any questions? You are in luck today. So there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 922, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, the motion prevails, and House File 922, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much.
Thank you for bearing with me on that very boring bill. Anyway.
All right. So we have Representative Elkins, House File, Senate File 131, Clinic Facility Fees Disclosures Required. The chair moves that Senate Files 131 be recommended for placement on the general register. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Elkins, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill comes to us from the Senate. My Senate co-authors are Senators Dreheim and Jensen, so this is one of the pricing transparency bills from originally over there. This one has already passed the Senate 63 to nothing. It's pretty simple, probably even more boring than the last bill, but it requires provider-based clinics to, before delivering non-emergency services, that if they charge a facility fee, and that doesn't always happen, but if they're going to charge a facility fee, it basically says they have to tell the patient about it ahead of time instead of surprising it when they get the bill. So it's fairly straightforward. These fees, some facilities charge them, some fees don't. So it's kind of hit or miss. But this just says if they're gonna, it's going to be one, they have to tell you about it first.
All right, I like simple.
Yeah.
Is there? You have a testifier, Bentley Graves. For the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
I was looking for him. Yes.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you're with, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate Representative Elkins bringing this legislation forward. This is legislation that we support. Increasingly, plan design in Minnesota has trended to plans with deductibles and high deductibles. And, in fact, in Minnesota's health insurance market, we have a higher prevalence of plans with high deductibles than almost any other state in the country. And so it's incredibly important that that consumers in Minnesota have access to information, pricing information, to ensure that they're able to engage in decisions about their health care, knowing that, you know, many of those decisions are going to have an impact on their pocketbook because of the requirement that they pay for much of the care on the front end out of pocket. And so these facility fees come at a cost to the consumer and increase the cost of receiving and getting care. And so we appreciate the legislation making it clear that this is information that has to be disclosed to the consumer, as, again, much of that cost is coming directly out of their pocket until they meet the deductible. So appreciate the opportunity to testify and to support this good bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 131? Any discussion from committee members? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification, is there a House file associated with this?
Yes. Madam Chair, the House equivalent House file is 685 because the bill has already passed the Senate and we're acting on it without exactly as it came to us from the Senate, we're acting on their bill.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Any further discussion? All right, there have been no further discussion. The chair renews a motion that Senate File 131 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and Senate File 131 is recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Okay, we have Representative Nash, House File 1393. The chair moves that House File 1393 be recommended for placement on the general register.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Glad to be here today. My name is Jim Nash, state representative from Carver County. I wanted to thank Representative Morrison for being a co-author on this bill. It's a pretty straightforward bill. In your bill summary, you'll see that, and on the pages, you'll see that it's merely making a change for Carver County. The hospital in Carver County is Ridgeview. And this is sort of a situation of what happens when everything goes right. And many of you work in healthcare, and you may have privileges at Ridgeview. It's really one of the most innovative hospitals in our state, It has provided a great service to the Southwest metro area, and it is really providing care and jobs to a great many people. It is the largest employer in Carver County. And the simple ask that we're making today is that we remove the restriction on the number of beds that they can use. So it's a pretty straightforward thing. And with me, I have the CEO, Mike Phelps, to offer his testimony, but would appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Phelps, the CEO of Ridgeview Medical Center, not the swimmer. So Ridgeview is, as Representative Nash said, a community health system that consists of three hospitals, two of them being critical access hospitals in rural communities, and one larger hospital in Waconia. We also have several clinics and multi-specialty clinics around the area, including the state's first 24-hour emergency department and urgent care center. In 2003, the legislation that granted our Waconia hospital a bed moratorium exception limited the use of the beds to rehabilitation services and also limited the use by stating that the beds could not be reimbursed through medical assistance or Minnesota Care. In our research, we could find no reason for the inclusion of those restrictions in 2003. The restrictions essentially limit our flexibility on how we would use the beds in the hospital, as well as how we're able to respond to patient needs in the future, as Representative Nash mentioned. It would also unnecessarily limit the use of the beds to people who were not on Minnesota healthcare programs, which in a not-for-profit health system seems contradictory to what we want to do. HF 1393 essentially removes both of those restrictions. In preparing our request, we did reach out to the impacted state agencies, the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. Neither expressed concerns about the changes we are seeking in HF 1393. Additionally, the Department of Health informed us that our proposed changes would not require a public interest review based on the information we presented to them. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to share our story, and I would appreciate your support for HF 1393.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Phelps. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Discussion from the committee. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing the bill. So to your testifier, you have no idea why they initially put this exclusion in there?
Mr.
No, we don't. In fact, we had several people do research on the prior legislation, and the only thing that we can think of is that there are some conversations about orthopedic services, surgical services, and the word rehabilitation kind of comes to mind when you're talking about those types of services, if you will.
No, I mean, I think it's a – thank you. I think it's – this is a great bill. I mean, we should not disclude people based on the type of insurance they have. So thank you for bringing this.
Yes.
Further discussion? No. Seeing none, Chair Moran renews her motion that House File 1393 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and
House
Bill 1993 is recommended for placement
on the
general
register. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Excuse me, 1393. Thank you, and congratulations. Tools.
Yes, in the gap.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wait a minute. Musical
sample. I take it from the file 584.
Right at the top.
What's that? Representative Morrison, would you like to bring your bill forward? I am a loss. Totally. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 584 be recommended for placement on the general register. Okay. Would you go ahead with your testimony? Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 584 modifies Minnesota Statutes Chapters 147 and 147A -F enforced by the Board of Medical Practice and establishes birth month renewal cycles within practice acts for allied professions, makes technical changes to codify established fees in individual practice acts for allied professions, and establishes authority for the Board of Medical Practice to oversee genetic counselors among its regulated allied health professions. and I will now turn it over to my testifier, Ruth Martinez.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. Some of you will be having some deja vu about this bill. It was successfully heard last year, but failed in an omnibus bill that was vetoed. So we're back. Not aware of any opposition to this bill. We are moving the allied professions to a birth month renewal cycle, not only to help folks remember when to renew their licenses, but it spreads our revenue across a calendar year and just brings it into alignment with how physicians renew their license. Our peak processing period happens to fall right on or around June 30th with residency permits, licenses, and so forth. And so this bill really just spreads everything across the calendar year, across all of our regulated professions. It also, genetic counselors came under our licensure a couple of years ago, and in a small section of our statute that gives us authority to regulate our allied professions, we overlooked adding the genetic counselors, so we've corrected that. We've also moved away from doing a lot of rule writing around fees. We find the legislative process is a much better place for managing our fees for our professions we regulate, and so we've moved fees out of rule into statute, but there are no fiscal impacts and no fee changes in this bill. And I'll address any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other attendees that would like to speak to this bill? For or against? Okay. Members, are there any questions for Representative Morrison? Okay. Any other discussion? Then, all right. So, Representative Morrison, did you have any other comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Just I urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's see, where are we passing this? House Senate File 484 will be passed.
584.
I need new glasses. Senate File 584 will be placed on the General Register. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Senate File 584. Head of the General Register.
Thank you,
Chair Moran. Would you like this back?
So I think we're going to move on to House File 1167, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1167 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. So we have the bill before the committee. Representative Morrison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, breast milk is well established as the best nutrition for newborns and infants. It has many maternal, infant, and societal benefits. Women who breastfeed have decreased postpartum blood loss, decreased risk of ovarian and breast cancer, decreased rates of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, decreased risk of postpartum depression, increased postpartum weight loss, and decreased rates of unintended pregnancy. Infants who are exclusively breastfed have decreased respiratory illnesses, decreased diarrheal disease, fewer visits to the doctor, which of course means less parental absenteeism from work and saves healthcare dollars, and decreased rates of childhood obesity. Breastfeeding enhances the mother-baby bond and improves long-term psychological well-being for both. Breast milk provides ideal nutrition for infants and is the most economical form of nutrition as it is free. The World Health Organization, the American Academy of Pediatricians, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists all recommend exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months of life. In spite of all of the well-documented health benefits of breastfeeding, initiation and continuation of breastfeeding among African American and American Indian women are much lower than their white counterparts. We need to study and understand why these disparities exist and create a plan of action to work to eliminate these gaps in Minnesota. House File 1167 aims to do just that. It directs the Commissioner of Health to carry out a study identifying barriers, challenges, and successes that affect initiation, duration, and exclusivity of breastfeeding and makes recommendations regarding culturally appropriate practices that have been shown to increase rates in populations that have the greatest breastfeeding disparity rate. As we work to address the gaps in infant and maternal mortality and overall health outcomes that exist in Minnesota, this is potentially an important piece of that puzzle. I urge your support.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Do you have no testifiers? Are there any?
I don't believe that I do.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1167? Okay, members, any discussion? Okay. Representative Ellison?
Okay. She wants to. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one really quick question. So for line 1.15, the report that must come back to the legislative committees that have jurisdiction, is that going to go to the Senate and the House and to the HHS committees then? Is that correct? Who's going to present the bill, I guess, the results that they find?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Edelson. It's being sent to the Commissioner of Health, but yes, the intent is that it's presented to both bodies. So I don't know exactly who the person would be that would present the results, but yes.
Representative Edelson.
So it'll be going through the Commissioner of Health then?
It's going through the Commissioner of Health, yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there are... breastfeeding is not always a super easy thing for many women to do, and it's really only free kind of if you assume women's time is not worth anything. I just want to make sure, you know, this is great. I know there are benefits to breastfeeding. I just want to make sure this doesn't women are under a lot of pressure as it is, especially after they give birth, and breastfeeding can be one of those, especially if a woman is having a hard time doing so. So can you just provide me some assurance that this won't pressure women in any way if they do have medical or other reasons why breastfeeding is challenging for them?
Representative Morrison.
Chair Moran, Representative Freiberg, thanks for the question. I'm acutely aware as an obstetrician of those challenges. And, you know, in some ways it's akin to wanting to increase vaginal delivery rates versus C-section rates. We're really glad that we have C-sections when we need them. We're really glad that formula exists when we need it. But all things being equal, breast milk is preferred. And we still have pretty big gaps in some communities. Breastfeeding doesn't work for everyone, and no one should be shamed by that. Many of us were raised on formula and turned out okay. But I appreciate the question.
Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, it's a great idea. I think... it wasn't a challenge in my family, although my daughter just had twins, and we learned all kinds of things that preemie infant twins have problems, and it was her seventh and eighth. So all the medical professionals assumed it wasn't a big deal because it was her seventh and eighth child, and it was. It was a challenge for the babies and was kind of interesting, the education that was involved. But I'm wondering, do you have any idea? I know that we're going to ask them to study it, but why are those barriers there for those groups of women? Is it that there's not enough education, or?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, we do know a lot on a national level. And, you know, it ranges from education as a piece of it, cultural practices are a piece of it, poverty is a piece of it. If you're having to go back to work at 2 weeks and you're not getting time for breaks to pump breast milk and you haven't even really had the chance to establish it with the infant, there are a lot of cultural and economic factors that contribute to it. But we don't have information that's specific to Minnesota, so I think it could be really useful to learn more about what's happening in our state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I guess I'll make this comment. It's so important. It can be a relaxing thing if it works well. It really honestly is very beneficial to the mom as well as the baby. So.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Well, there have been no further discussion. Representative Morrison renews a motion that House File 1167 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1167 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
members.
You so much. So the next person up would be House File 1262, which would be me. Okay.
Wait.
All right, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 584 be recommended for placement on the general register. I'm sorry, 1262. I'm taking.
Are we doing 1262?
1262 be recommended for placement on the general register.
We have the bill before the committee. Chair Moran, I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, and I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Chair Moran moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Moran, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 1262 recodifies the Minnesota Marriage and Family Therapy Practice Act. It does not make any substantive changes to existing laws. It removes obsolete language and updates terminology. It removes provisions now found elsewhere in statute and organizes the statutory sections in a more logical order. The Office of the Revisor recommends such updates and works with the board in drafting the bill, which, again, is not intended to make substantive changes to existing laws. I will let my testifier elaborate further on the bill. I have with me today Jennifer
Mollenhoff,
who is the Executive Director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy.
Please state your name again for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jennifer Mollenhoff. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, the state regulatory board that licenses marriage and family therapists in Minnesota. Chair Moran did an excellent summary. The bill is really just almost termed a technical change bill. It was the board staff was approached by the Office of the Revisor staff to address the fact that our Practice Act had not been tweaked at all in several years, perhaps closer to 20, and contained a lot of outdated terminology and also was poorly organized and included a lot of provisions that have now been codified elsewhere in statute, and prepared a bill that, like, recodifies the provisions in a more logical order and removes outdated terminology and outdated language. Again, no substantive changes to our existing Marriage and Family Therapy Practice Act are intended by the changes in this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1262? Discussion from the committee. There being no further discussion, Chair Moran renews her motion that House File 1262 as amended be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1262 as amended is recommended for placement on the general register.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 2150 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
All right. Representative Schumacher, we have the bill before the committee. Can you please present your bill?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill today, Madam Chair and members. Before you is House File 2150, a bill to allow prescriptions for ED medication to be issued via telehealth visits. Under current law, most drugs can be prescribed via telehealth. However, six types of drugs listed in Chapter 151.37 specifically require an in-person visit to receive a telehealth visit, including ED medications. After a tragedy in St. Cloud where a young man was receiving fraudulent prescriptions for addictive medications was found dead, Senator Marty and Representative Gottwald worked together to pass the language we are seeking to amend. We worked with Senator Marty to make sure that we had crafted a solution that respected his original intent of the statute. This bill does not lift the prohibition. Rather, it allows a telehealth visit for the purpose of prescription only when the visit meets telehealth requirements set forth in Chapter 147, requiring the same standards as an in-person visit. Only after receiving Senator Marty's blessing and confirming with the Board of Pharmacy, which is not here today, we decided to move this bill forward and seek a hearing. With me to provide more information are Dr. Melinda Barnes and Adam Greenberg. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you are with, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Adam Greenberg. I'm the General Counsel of Roe, spelled R-O, testifying in support of House File 2150. Roe is a telemedicine and telepharmacy startup that has helped hundreds of thousands of Americans receive medical treatment for conditions that are often left untreated. Today, Roe operates three brands. The first is Roman, a men's health service that treats erectile dysfunction, oral and genital herpes, and other chronic conditions for which men far too often do not seek medical care. The second is Rory, a women's health service that treats symptoms of perimenopause and menopause that are often unaddressed. And the third is Zero, an addiction treatment service that helps men and women quit smoking cigarettes, the number one preventable cause of death in the U.S. Minnesota recognized the benefits of telemedicine in 2017 when it unanimously passed Statute 147.033. Today, telemedicine is ubiquitous in the country. Roe is already working with Minnesota licensed doctors to treat conditions like herpes, hot flashes, and nicotine addiction through telemedicine. Doctors on our platform are also treating men with ED in 45 states today. However, we are blocked from offering the service in Minnesota due to a 2008 pharmacy law that put ED medication on a list of potentially addictive and dangerous drugs. This medication, which is called PDE5 inhibitors, is much different than the drugs on that list. It is not addictive, not psychoactive, and typically very safe. In your materials, you will see letters from renowned physicians who agree. When legitimate options are not available online, ED patients may be drawn to dangerous alternatives like online pill mills where prescription is not required. One study found that over 80% of the Viagra bought online was counterfeit. House File 2150 is an amendment to that 2008 pharmacy law that clarifies that physicians may conduct a telemedicine exam for ED so long as it is compliant with the 2017 telemedicine law. This bill keeps necessary safeguards in place while giving Minnesota licensed physicians the latitude to do what physicians across the rest of the country are doing today. I'm now going to turn things over to my colleague, Dr. Barnes.
Yes, hi. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, who you're with, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Melinda Barnes, and I'm the Associate Clinical Director at Roe. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify today in support of House File 2150. I'm a graduate of Stanford University and Mount Sinai School of Medicine. I completed my clinical training at Stanford University Hospital, and I'm a double board certified physician. As a clinical director at Roe, I'm responsible for creating all of the medical materials and physician guidelines as it relates to the provision of care on the Roe platform. While ED is often mislabeled as a lifestyle issue, it is a real medical condition. It profoundly affects a man's well-being, his wellness, and quality of life. ED can also have a profound impact on a man's relationship. Research shows that more than 52% of men over the age of 40 and 26% of men under the age of 40 experience ED at some point in their lives. Also, over 80% of male combat vets who are also diagnosed with PTSD are diagnosed with ED. Despite this prevalence, only 25% of men talk to their doctor about their ED and get treatment. Why is that? There are a number of reasons. First and foremost, the perceived stigma associated with ED can be a barrier for men to initiate a face-to-face conversation with their doctor, whether out of embarrassment or fear of others finding out. Second, patients often lack access to convenient care options or don't have local providers familiar with the condition. This lack of access can be especially profound for patients who live in rural communities. Additionally, doctors often fail to inquire about a patient's sexual health. In fact, one study found that 75% of providers fail to address male sexual function during routine in-person visits. Fortunately, we can leverage technology to close these treatment gaps and expand access to legitimate ED treatment. Telemedicine provides an opportunity for patients to initiate care and overcome the stigma of ED while giving providers a platform to safely and appropriately provide treatment remotely. As the clinical director of the hundreds of doctors in our network, I have witnessed how telemedicine has enhanced the provider experience and results in care that meets and sometimes exceeds care that's delivered in person. By eliminating burdensome paperwork like scheduling and streamlining the provider's workflow, telemedicine allows doctors to devote their time to what they do best, treating patients. Telemedicine platforms like Roe also open up new revenue streams to doctors, many of whom are paying off their student loans and raising families. Further, our physicians report that telemedicine visits on the Rogue platform allow for a more honest exchange and often generate more information than what they would receive during an in-person visit. It's important to remember that telemedicine is not just a different type of medical care. It's just one possible tool for delivering health care. It's an important tool that expands all Minnesotans' access to high-quality, convenient, and cost-effective care, and it's a tool that should be available to Minnesota licensed physicians who want to safely and appropriately treat men suffering with erectile dysfunction. I also want to highlight that by meeting patients at eye level and where their current pain points are, we can reintroduce them to the healthcare system for patients who are not waiting the 30 days to see their providers in person. We can actually provide them an alternative healthcare delivery system where we can start to address either underlying causes of their erectile dysfunction or other comorbid conditions that they may have, like diabetes or high cholesterol. So with that, I strongly encourage this committee to approve House File 2150 to confirm that doctors can use telemedicine technologies to prescribe treatment for erectile dysfunction. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 2150? Okay, members, any discussion? Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schumacher, do you know, I actually find it interesting that this Clause 6 is in the bill to begin with, and I'm wondering, these PDE5 inhibitors, do we know why this is included? I assume they treat other things since it is specified in Clause 6 that they're only, that this only applies to when they are used to treat erectile dysfunction. Are they used for other things? And is there a reason that this was excluded or included in Clause 6 to begin with?
Representative Schumacher or Dr. Barnes or...
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. So PDE5s were initially approved to treat congestive heart failure, and then it was noted to have this other side effect. So currently, the only treatment that's standard of care for erectile dysfunction would be PDE5 inhibitors, and no one really treats congestive heart failure with PDE5 inhibitors. There's much better drugs for that indication. We were talking about this earlier, and we thought that maybe one of the reasons why it was included in this list is that there are, as Mr. Greenberg reported, that there's a high rate of counterfeit Viagra, and so given this case where the young man who had the overdose was dealing with a fraudulent doctor who was dealing with different pharmacies, there's also cases of patients receiving counterfeit narcotics as well, and so I think it may have been lumped into this because it was a drug that was frequently purchased online that was also counterfeit.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schumacher and to the testifiers. Can you give me some of the most common conditions for which the this would, or reasons why someone would suffer from this condition?
Dr. Vaughn.
Madam Chair, Representative. So ED is very much multifactorial. Some underlying conditions that can contribute to erectile dysfunction would be conditions that also contribute to decreased blood flow to other parts of the body. So in that vein, it would be smoking, diabetes, high cholesterol, cardiovascular disease like atherosclerosis. For most men, it is multifactorial. It's not just one thing.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that sometimes the cause can also be related to other medications that someone may be taking. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair. Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to be upfront. I'm struggling with this bill. I'm a little bit nervous about it. And the reason being that, you know, when you have patients, for example, who have things like diabetes, high blood pressure and hypertension, who have other complications that are very likely the cause of this disorder, and or particularly other drugs that they're taking, and then we're suggesting that we're going to prescribe something without A, fully addressing the underlying conditions, and B,
talking about other potential drug interactions and just doing that without addressing those other issues, I have to be honest, this one makes me very nervous. I understand the intent of wanting to create more access, and because this can be something that, for lack of a better term, can be a little bit embarrassing for folks to seek out treatment, and I appreciate that. But it feels like the primary part of being a legislator should be to do no harm. And I am a little concerned that this bill has the potential to have folks being treated for things without having those underlying conditions treated, and that that in the end could actually do more harm than the benefit that it provides.
Okay. Who's like to respond to that? Representative Schumacher or Dr. Barnes? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the best way to respond to that is to actually go through the process of what the visit would seem or what would happen during a visit. It's my understanding that fewer than 14% of the people who actually start the process through this telehealth appointment actually end up with the prescription, and I think Dr. Barnes can reflect on a bit on why.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great, all those are great points, and I would love to, you know, have the opportunity to just walk through what an online visit actually entails. So the patients are not coming online just to buy medications. They're coming online to be evaluated by a U.S. licensed physician who's licensed in the state of Minnesota. Our online visit is made up of at least two dozen questions that the potential patient has to answer. We have dynamic, adaptive onboarding or an online visit where all the logic is written by board-certified physicians on our clinical team. So if someone answers that they have had, that they have cardiovascular disease or that they have diabetes or that they take any number of medications such as nitrates, that person is, those answers are either highlighted so that the physician who's evaluating the patient can see that, or the patient is actually routed to in-person care and no longer allowed to continue in the online visit because they've been deemed inappropriate for telemedicine. So one of the benefits of technology is that we can actually check for all of the drug interactions for the medications that we prescribe because we have a computer that can run through all of the different drug interactions. We actually pull data from DoseSpot so we can see what other prescriptions the member is on. And you can compare or contrast that to in-person care where a physician either has to remember all the potential drug interactions as they look over the person's list of medications, or they can refer to the PDR or Hippocrates. But we've tried to leverage the benefits of telemedicine. So that's providing the physicians with the information that they need to evaluate the patient. So no one's coming through signing up and getting a medication. All the answers that they reply with are evaluated by a physician who then makes a treatment recommendation, which can be that the person is unsuitable for telemedicine, that the medication is safe and appropriate for them, or that they do not meet diagnostic criteria, or they have a contraindication for medication. So those are the different treatment responses that the physician can make once they evaluate the patient. The other thing, I lost my train of thought. Talking about contraindications. So we ask for everything, medication, the medication that the patients are taking, medication history, surgical history, family history. Thought just came back. And that was why we created Zero, our smoking cessation brand, our addiction brand, was because we collect lifestyle data on our members as well. So we ask them, do you smoke? Are you 20 pounds overweight? Do you get exercise? Do you have shortness of breath when walking up two flights of stairs? We've noticed that a lot of the patients who were coming in for erectile dysfunction were checking off that they were smokers as well. And we know that smoking is the number one cause of preventable deaths in the United States, and it's also contributing to erectile dysfunction. So we find that right now we know that only 25% of men are even talking about issues with their doctors, and we know that an even significant number of men are not even going to the doctor. So if we can connect them to the healthcare system with something that's bothering them right now, we feel like that's a step forward. We can then start to address issues like diabetes and high cholesterol, and we also highly encourage all of our members to see their primary care physician every year. And in fact, For a men's health brand, you have to have been seen by a physician within the last 3 years, and you have to have a recent blood pressure measurement to even continue through the visit. So we are not trying to circumvent. We're just trying to provide an alternative healthcare delivery system that increases access to care and also reconnects people to the healthcare system.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. So the one question that I have, though, is, you know, you said you ask a lot of questions about a patient's history, which is good. You also asked about medications that they're currently taking. Now, I know that even in a doctor's office, one of the struggles often is that folks don't remember what they're on. And sometimes they have the pill bottle, and they can remember. The one advantage, of course, of being in an office setting is that generally the doctor can pull up a list of all the medications that the patient is on and verify those, whereas here I'm not sure if that's happening. So I guess what are the fail-safes to be addressing that you have in place to look into that and make sure that we're covering those bases?
Dr. Barnes.
Yes, Madam Chair. So one is we pull in all of the electronic prescription medication through SureScript. So we have that as a database for all the medications that patients are on. Secondly, that's actually one of the benefits of going through the online visit is that patients frequently will stop their visit if they're doing it from work. They can go home, their place is saved, and then they can actually fill in all of their medications. So we have structured medications, so even if someone is typing metoprolol but they're not spelling it correctly, our system, the technology, can actually bring up all of the medications that start with M-E-T and give them a list so they can click on it, and then they can fill in their dosage and how frequently they take the medication. But like our physicians have brought back to us, we have better records on what our patients are taking in terms of members listing 10, 12 vitamin supplements because they have time to go home, type in everything that's in their medicine cabinet, and then we can also pull in that information from SureScript. So the physicians on our platform very often remark that they feel like they have more information on the patients because they have more time to evaluate the patient, but also the patients have time to actually fill out all of that information.
So this is the thing, you know, I don't know if you guys know, I've been out with the flu, right? So by last Wednesday, I made a phone call. I have health partners. So what I do and what health partners allow you to do is go online. You can go online, you can fill out a data sheet of all the symptoms that you have, how you feel, any, you know, heart disease or whatever you may have, and they call you back. So a nurse will call you back and say, we just looked at this to ask you a few more questions. And the beauty of this, I thought, was I didn't have to leave my house. Because the doctor was like, you have the flu. You have symptoms of the flu. We're going to send you a prescription. Here's the Tamiflu. I was able to call my son up and say, go pick it up, bring it to me, done. Right? But all the information that was available about me through Health Partner, it was there. It was visible for them to see. And they was really, really good about being thorough with the questions, as you stated, to really get to what was wrong with me and how they can best treat me. So, Dr. Barnes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make one last point. This is, to Representative Bonner, your point is very well taken about sort of how do we know what patients are on, which I think is a larger symptom of the problem of healthcare in America right now, and that if I go to the doctor at Mount Sinai and then I go to the doctor at NYU because I live in New York, neither one of those doctors know what my health history is. They cannot see that EMR between the two hospitals. And so our practice really is similar in that, in struggling with how do we get the information, how do we connect to the primary care doctors, how do we connect to the other hospital systems. But that's something that all hospital systems are struggling with across the country. But I do, you know, again, with technology and the ability to link to SureScripts, pull in all the electronic prescription medication, giving patients time to sit down, think about their medical history, go through their records if they need to, go back home, look in the medicine cabinet, write everything down. We are accumulating a ton of data. And again, our physicians who are all licensed to practice medicine in the United States and in Minnesota for Minnesotans oftentimes remark that they feel like they have a lot more information.
Yeah. We just have some data privacy issues we got to get past because, yeah. You know, knowing that the physicians are only sharing information about your health with other physicians, and it's not in the cyber world for everyone to pick up. But that's a whole other issue that we have to deal with as we look at our healthcare system.
Madam Chair, we have a little bit more clarification on that too, or an additional step of security that we'd like to talk a little bit about.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. Two additional clarification points about how our platform works. One is that there is a real-time component as well, either a phone call between the patient and the physician or a video chat between the patient and physician, depending on what state law requires. So we've built our platform and our software to be compliant with whatever state the patient lives in. And there's also a continuity of care component that for the length of the prescription, the patient has full access at no additional cost to the doctor to message the doctor or call the doctor. So out of pocket for the doctor visit, patients are typically paying only around $15, and they have the full access to that doctor based on those $15 for the full year to ask any questions about the medication they're taking or about other components of their health. Also, on the pharmacy side, we wanted to clarify that if a doctor believes it's safe and appropriate to write a prescription, the patient has a choice of what pharmacy to use to fulfill that script. So they can either use our online pharmacy, and if they do that, the medication will be sent in discrete packaging in 2 business days, or the patient could choose to use a local pharmacy, and we will transmit the prescription to whichever pharmacy he or she likes.
Yeah, I can echo that. It just happened to me. Just utilize it. So, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schumacher, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I appreciated the conversation that Dr. Barnes and Mr. Rowe had with me in my office. I think from my perspective, you know, telehealth, all while we were talking about this issue, I think when we talk about it in the broader perspective, we think about, and you brought up this, Dr. Barnes, from the relevancy or the poignancy for veterans. You know, that's a group of service personnel who have been trained to be individual and to survive on their own. And the problem is that when they do come up against a medical condition, in most often cases, as has been apparent with my son who just retired from the Marines, you take Advil. Advil cures everything in marine land, and I'm not kidding. Just take, you know, take two, you know, take 4 Advil or take 5 Advil and call me in the morning. But it points them to your point when we had the conversation about it underlying co-occurring situations that are maybe even more worrisome or should be more worrisome for the patient themselves. You know, is it about hypertension? Is it about the potential that they're on the verge of a heart attack or a stroke, or are they losing their hearing, not because of, you know, gunfire or machine artillery fire, but could it be something else relevant to another condition underlying that? And so all the while we're talking about one condition, I think what's really, really important, particularly for veterans and for men in general, men's health, men are probably loath to go and seek out medical attention for even the simplest of situations. We're just going to kind of just rough it through, but that doesn't always turn out well. And so I appreciate the fact that telehealth gives them an audience to do it, not so much discreetly, but conveniently, whether they're at work, at night, or on the weekends, and be able to interact, particularly with the opportunity to talk live with a physician and point them in a direction that is going to help them stay out of an emergency room, stay out of a long-term commitment to hospitalization for the benefit of their families and for their workplace and whatnot. So I applaud your testimony. I applaud the work of Representative Schumacher, and I'm in full support of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Schumacher, for bringing this bill. And thank you, Dr. Barnes, for your work, and you guys for I think you've been very thoughtful about the necessary safeguards to do this safely and carefully. I signed on to it because I think people deserve privacy when making sensitive healthcare decisions, particularly regarding their sexual health. Erectile dysfunction is a very sensitive and relatively prevalent issue, and I think men deserve the privacy that the service offers. So I just wanted to say thank you, and thank you, Representative Schumacher.
Is there any other questions? Okay, there being no further discussion, Representative Schumacher renewed his motion that House File 2150 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 2150 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you all. All right, so members, this is our last committee hearing in Health and Human Service Policy. This is it. It is. This is it for us.
But it could be.
There may be, you know, we may have some informational hearings later on. But as far as our scheduled bill hearing, this is it. So I really wanted to thank everyone here. I want to thank Representative Kill, who is the lead for the Republican Party. I do want to thank all the members who was really considerate about participating and being a part of Health and Human Service Policy. Those of you who have, I mean, we went through a lot of bills this session with a lot of discussion in this committee. And I just want to say, as the chair who was learning this process, I want to thank you all for being so patient with me as we move through this committee to do the good work of the people in the state of Minnesota. I want to thank our pages over there, Emily and Catherine, who have been champions during this time. Catherine over there and Emily there. Thank you so much for your support and help as the pages of this committee. And so as we end today on March the 27th, Wednesday, I bid you all well. But just keep in mind that at some point there are a few more bills that we would like to have some informational hearings on that would take place maybe in the interim, but also during the session. So thank you all for being here, and we are adjourned. Thank you.